Hello and welcome to an episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at stevedunk5 or at everythingcanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Akemi Don Bowman all about her excellent debut middle grade book, Generation Misfits, which is described as a heartwarming, fish-out-of-water story about an 11-year-old Japanese-American girl who finds her true friends through the power of J-pop. This true-to-life story is about the power of found family, friendship, and music, and how you never quite forget those friends you had in high school. But more than just good times, Generation Misfits deals with all sorts of important issues that these friends will realize that some things are better faced together than alone. Whether you're homeschooled like Millie, popular like Luna, passionate like Zuki, courageous like Ashley, or shy like Rainbow, this book has just about something for everyone. We talk about the launch of Infinity Courts, some sensitive publishing hot topics, Generation Misfits, of course, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. And this, of course, should be done all year long. July, as a month, doesn't have a predominant social media holiday, although July 30th is International Friendship Day. So let's just go with that. Try and be a friend to someone who needs it, someone who's hurting in some way. Try and throw some words of encouragement towards them in their direction so they know they're not alone. Speaking of friends, my friend, Akemi Don Bowman, is a well-traveled, I said that earlier, I'm making you sound like old and haggard. You're not. And she's a critically acclaimed author who writes across multiple genres. Her novels have received many accolades and award nominations. Her first novel, Starfish, was a William C. Morris Award finalist. Her fourth YA novel, The Infinity Courts, the first in a new series, was released in April, with Kirkus saying, Bowman asks readers to question what it means to be human and to forgive, an intriguing speculative world that interrogates consciousness and humanity. It was a really great book, and I think she had a good release, but we'll ask her all about it. But she's here today to talk about her new debut middle grade book, Generation Misfits, which is described as a heartwarming fish out of water, own voices story about an 11-year-old Japanese-American girl who finds her true friend through the power of J-pop. Please welcome back to the show my friend and the coolest person I know in Scotland, Akemi Don Bowman. Hi, Akemi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me back on.
We're going to pretend like we weren't just talking for the past hour.
Yeah, that's fine. So, you know what I noticed too? The whole time we were talking, I've been leaning on my couch and it's been squeaking, but I couldn't hear
it
because my head.
No, I didn't hear it. Didn't even notice.
I was like, oh, good. Okay. But I was like, I better not do that while we're actually recording this.
Keep doing what you're doing because I actually didn't hear it or notice anything. So
okay, that's all right then.
No, be comfortable. Be relaxed. Yep. So listen, we're friends, we talk offline, stuff like that, but we haven't officially talked since you were on the show last time, and that was right before Infinity Courts came out. So how was the launch? How did the reception go for Infinity Courts?
I mean I don't know, if I'm being honest, it's like the worst author. I try to avoid as much as I can, because I just kind of like, it's too much. It's too much to worry about. There's too many things that I'll never know. And the weird thing about like when a book comes out too, is like you see stuff online, but that's actually what I've been told, is that it's very like a small percentage of what the actual percentage of readers is. And I kind of can agree with this based on what my like royalty statements and stuff have been for my previous books, you know?
Yep.
And so sometimes it just feels very quiet and you're just thinking like, has anybody even read this? I don't know. And then, you know what I mean? And then 6 months later you get your, you know, paperwork in the mail and then you're like, okay, people are reading it. But like that first 6 months is just kind of like this terrifying, like, I don't actually know. I could not tell you right now if people are reading it or not, but I hope so.
Right. And that's, I remember like Case and Calendar writing a really great blog a while ago about, you know, the pressure to go on social media and interact and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's like, it barely moves the needle, right?
Yeah.
Even when it goes well, even when like you're getting a ton of hits and likes and shares and whatever and retweets, it barely moves the needle. He said, mm-hmm. And he goes, which is hard because especially when you're facing, you know, the mob, right? So yeah. Like, because there are, I don't know if you know this, Akemi, but there's tends to be some negativity online. In general, right? Just in the world. And it's, you know, and Twitter's, of course, no stranger to that negativity. And so to his point, he's like, you know, if it's only going to sell an extra 100 or 200 books, is it worth my well-being? You know, is it worth my sanity? So, you know, I know you tried, you sort of eased up on Twitter there not long ago, and, you know, focus more on Instagram and stuff like that. And have you felt that difference in you personally? Like, you feel a little better?
Oh, significantly. I actually really, really dislike Twitter a lot. I don't enjoy it.
Yep.
I think the weird stuff that I would just tweet if I was just being myself, probably like nobody would even get my weird sense of humor anyway. Like, it would just be, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just pointless. And then it's kind of like, well, I'm just like talking in a room. I don't know. Maybe I should just have a fun one and then whatever. But Twitter's not my thing. It's just not my thing. And even Instagram, I feel like it takes a lot of effort to like think of captions. Maybe I'm just like a lazy social media person.
I'm horrible at Instagram. I'm no good at it because it takes a lot of work. I'm in awe of the people who are good at it. Like, there are some people and some authors who are just like fucking magical on it. Like, it's impressive. Mm-hmm. So what limited exposure you did have, you know, you did some event, a couple of launch events and stuff like that. So people seem pretty stoked, I think, with the Infinity Courts.
Yeah, I hope so. And the people who've been, you know, who've tagged me occasionally in like something in you know, where they have like those paragraphs of reasons they loved it and stuff. And that's been really nice. And it's nice to think that, you know, there's at least some people looking forward to the second one and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it's been okay. But I mean, you know, we'll see. I'll know more in 6 months.
Right. When the check comes in the mail, that'll tell you. Yeah, for sure. Either way, because it's a contractual agreement, you are writing more books anyways for Infinity Court. So where are we at with book two? Not obviously not spoilers and details, just is it done? Is it handed in? Is it drafting, editing? Where are we at?
Oh my God, that's like a TED talk of an answer. Probably I'll tell you more in another detail. Okay. The short story. The short story is that I'm getting near the end of edits, I think. And actually I just turned them in this morning, weirdly. So
for book two.
For book two. So if they get approved, I think we're like rolling along. I've seen the cover. I know the title. Yeah. I've seen the second map, which I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but so good things.
Okay. Yeah. And you're feeling good about it?
I think so. Again,
personally, I don't mean how people can react to it. I just mean yourself. Cause at the end of the day, it's your story. Like, we can't take that away from you. Right? Like, you're the one who's spending time with these people more than we are. And you've thought about it for much longer than that. So, you know, at the end of the day, if you're not happy, then who gives a fuck, right? Like, it's so...
Right, yeah. It's a weird thing because this series, I love this series. I know maybe you're not supposed to say that, but I love this world that, like, you know, I made up.
Why are you supposed to say that?
You're not supposed to say that. I know, I'm sorry.
No, but, I'm saying why... No, I'm asking you, why aren't you supposed to say that?
Oh, I don't know.
Is that a thing? I've never heard that. You're allowed to like your own book, aren't you? I don't know.
Am I? Maybe. Sure. Okay. Well, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is, like, so I like, out of all the books I've written, I feel like this is the one that was the most fun for me to just feel like this is so self-indulgent in the sense of, like, this is the book that I wanted to read when I was like a teenager looking for books on the shelf. Like, this was it. This would have been everything to me. Right. But like, as you're writing, I feel like during the editing process, like, I have to read this book like 150 times.
Right.
And so you kind of lose sight of like what it's even about. Like, I feel like everything's starting to glaze in that stage right now, but I think that usually passes like when I get like copy edits back, then it's like, okay, now it feels good.
Right. So, on. Good. Yeah. Good. I've totally forgotten this. Is it a duology or a trilogy?
It's a trilogy. Yeah.
Okay.
It got announced. Yeah.
That's, I didn't know that. I'd forgotten. You haven't even started writing book three yet. I mean, obviously you've outlined it at some point or whatever, but you haven't actually sat down to like, do it.
Yeah. Not right. Yet. That's coming up next. And I do sort of know how it's going to end. So.
Okay.
Yeah. It'll be fun.
Has anything about the story changed? I mean, I'm sure things have changed during the editing process. They usually do, right? But anything, and not asking you to tell me what, obviously, but anything significant that surprised you, maybe that you're like, oh, I didn't think I'd ever change that, but I ended up changing it.
Not yet, but maybe for book three.
Right,
possibly for book three. Book two has gone pretty much like how I mostly envisioned, you know, with obviously my wonderful editor helped bring it out. Actually, I had two editors for this book. So, and you know, they helped bring out the points that they felt should be you know, magnified and all that, which is great.
Because it's the anchor, right? It's the glue. So like,
right?
In a trilogy anyways, right? So, and you think the ending of book three is sort of like rock solid? You're pretty sure that's how it's going to go?
I'm pretty sure.
You can't predict the future, obviously. But
yeah, there's one part that I'm still like, I feel like it's the right thing to do for the story.
Yep.
Don't know how people will feel about it, but I feel like for the story, we'll see. But yeah, I'm feeling good about it. I'm excited. It's the first time I've ever written a series. So this is like being able to wrap it up is kind of like a very new, weird thing for me. But it's going to be cool.
Somebody I follow, another blogger, a popular one, posted something about Infinity Courts today on Twitter, actually.
Oh, did they? Mm. Oh, I hope it was nice.
No, it was. No, I won't waste time looking for it. Look, just sneak back onto Twitter late at night and just you'll see it. I'm sure they would tag you in it. It was nice. It was one of those bloggers who like does a full makeup thing and like poses with the book and
that's nice.
It was really cool. All right. So, well, we'll look forward to that, obviously. I'm a fan of the first book, so I'm in for the whole trilogy unless things go really left in the second book go really crazy, but I don't see that happening. I do want to ask about, so one of the things too, last time we spoke officially was you were in between dogs and now you have a new dog named Maze. She's a little puppy, and I know how important dogs are to you and animals in general, so just bask in new puppy mommy glow for a minute for us then. Just tell us how great it is and how much of a rascal she is.
She is a total rascal. She's the best though. I mean, I had my previous two dogs, like from when I moved out of the house, that was the thing that I wanted. I wanted a dog and all that kind of stuff. And so when they left, you know, I say left because it's too sad to say the other thing, but since they've been gone, it's just been very weird in the house. Like even in the evenings, like sometimes I just go to bed at like, you know, go upstairs. I'm working from bed, but I go up to bed at like 7 PM because I literally can't stay down here. It's too quiet and sad. Uh-huh. So it's been nice to have like a friend around just to keep me company and to hang out with, but she is definitely always getting up to no good.
Is she like your writing partner? Is she sit right with you when you're writing, or is she on your lap or even on your keyboard, or is she, do you like an empty room when you're writing?
When I have my laptop and I've worked from the living room, she's occasionally like snuggled next to me, but I have a desktop that is actually like my main like writing work computer.
Yep.
And she is, no way is she allowed in my office. There's way too many Funko Pops and books and she would destroy it. So it's off limits. I barely even let the kids in there.
Okay. Right. No, that's cool. That's your fortress of solitude, right?
That's my fortress of solitude. She's a chewer. My previous dogs were not chewers. They were actually like really good in comparison, but she anything that's wood, dirt, like anything, she will eat it. So, yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah. That's what they do. We've talked about this. I've got some of my own, and like they'll eat anything that's not tied to the floor. And if it's tied to the floor, they'll spend their time making sure it's not tied to the floor. Yeah. That's what they do. So yeah, if you don't like, you know, shoes, and don't get attached to shoes.
Gosh.
And
don't even want to talk about shoes.
Yeah. Right. So weird. Yeah. It must be the smell, right? I don't know what it is, but they love chewing on shoes. And
I don't know. She had chalk earlier. I was telling you before we
started. Yeah.
And she has this hole. So we have a trampoline outside and she's dug this hole. Like she's digging to the center of the earth and like, she just sticks her whole head in it. And like, so she's puts the chalk in there because she knows that it's a pain to get under that trampoline to get to that hole. And so she just like hoards the stuff that she knows she's not supposed to have. And like,
they're too smart. Eh?
They are too smart.
It's just scary. Yeah. I mean, it's like, God, it's so funny. I'm just thinking now over the years of some of the crazy shit they do. And it's such mm-hmm. I don't know. It's so funny, but, well, that's glad. I'm very happy for you because I knew it was I've got two now, and then the one we had before, she died from mm-hmm. cancer. And so I wasn't sure at first if I was going to get another dog right away or not. And mm-hmm. I was fucking, first of all, when I emerged from the bedroom a week later from just crying for like a week straight in my bed, I had to take a week off work. And I was so depressed because she was one of the dogs too that went with me everywhere. If I went to the store, she came with me. Like she was just, she was my buddy, right? She went everywhere. So that It was like losing a limb, right? So,
yeah.
And then what killed me was coming home to a quiet house, because usually they run to the door, yeah, and greet you, right? Like, and they're mm-hmm. jumping and kissing and barking. They're so excited. That energy was just, it, when that's gone, God, you've missed that. Eh? You feel like you've got, I know you've got kids and stuff, and maybe they mm-hmm. sort of fill that role a little bit too, but you know, I don't. So I like, yeah, you know, my wife's not home. I come and she doesn't come running to the door to greet me, as much as I'd love it if she did. She doesn't do that, right? It's just, you know, that's actually like 10 minutes where I'm even wondering if someone's home. So, and then I ran into a friend of mine who had dogs, and I was just out literally moping around, and they're like, you look like shit. I'm like, thanks. And they're like, we heard about Cindy, and you know, so sorry. And we're like, she's like, get another dog right now. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm thinking about it. She's like, no, like right now, like go today, go to the Humane Society, get another dog. And I went home that day and I found Carl online. And we went and got him like the next day, or, well, you get approved, right? Oh, so it takes a couple of days, and he like literally saved my life. Like he's now he's like 15 and old and dying, and it's been a long journey. But anyways, yeah. So it was that, to your point, like just that coming home and that energy not being there, it's quiet and just when you've had it, right? So anyways.
Yeah. It is like an emptiness. And like, I do have kids, but you know, they have bedtimes, which is obviously different to mine normally. So,
right.
I mean, sometimes I'm just tired, but yeah. But when you have the dog, you're usually up to like, you know, 10, you let them out. There's a whole thing that goes, you know, and like, that's usually the snuggle time because the dog's tired too. And then, yeah, it's just empty and sad.
It is. And so anyways, yeah, I'm very happy that Maisie is in your life, and I've seen pictures of her, and she's just a little gorgeous little puppy. So she's going to stay that size, or is she going to get much bigger?
No, I think she's supposed to sort of like be a beagle size. I think she's a Cavachon. So she's a King Charles and a Bichon Frise mix.
Right.
Which they're supposed to be hypoallergenic because I have allergies.
Right.
But
right.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not 100% sure it's working. I have sneezed a lot in the last month.
Oh no. I wonder if it's both of those she's breeds are supposed to be.
I think just one. So I think that's what it is.
But so that's what happened. Okay.
Yeah. She's nowhere near as bad. Like, I've been around my my in-laws German Shepherd, and that's right. I can't eat, my eyes water. It's bad. So hers is just sneezing now and then. So you know, there's obviously a difference.
Such a cruel God, eh? Like
to give me allergy. Yes. I know. Like, give me a peanut allergy or something.
Right.
I'd be fine.
Yeah.
Like,
I'll take any food allergy over.
I'm a vegetarian. I'll take a shellfish allergy.
It's so cruel, eh? Like, fuck him. Fuck you, God.
She's sweet though.
And so very, very happy for you. And that's such a great, and it's the only thing dog people can say to each other. Cause you know, screw you cat people anyway. So we were talking a little bit sort of about, you know, deadlines and how to handle them, not how to handle deadlines, but sort of the downtime in between deadlines. And mm-hmm. this isn't your first book, obviously. You've got a few now, fourth YA book officially released. So just even go back maybe before, just pandemic's not a good measure of anything, right? But
yeah,
how about before, like when you were in between deadlines, how did you handle that? What did you do to sort of get your mind off, you know, being in the zone? You just like, did you drink a lot? Did you go shopping a lot? Yeah. Did you play any sports? Like, what, like, let's do a little sort of in-class thing. Like, what do you think is a good healthy thing authors can do in between deadlines? Cause like, you know, you've talked about it. We talked about it, how it's like you get into this zone, into this high, and then all of a sudden that's gone. Right. Cause you've handed in your book.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't have a good answer, because I don't think I pick any healthy things in between. I'm like, I play video games. I do that. And
that's fine. Yeah. That's a great,
yeah,
great one.
Well, yeah. You sort of like, on one side, you're thinking like, oh yeah, that's relaxing and nice. But like, I do it because it actually like makes me think about book ideas.
I was going to say, unless you're like critiquing the story in the game.
That's exactly. I know it's terrible. Yeah. And like the music, and I'm listening to the soundtrack. And so it's usually inspiring me. Like Sims is like one of the easiest ones, because you just shut your brain down. And then I'm just thinking about plot lines, and I'm thinking about other stuff. So it's like a weird way to keep my brain going while I'm also
working. I think that's okay. Right. So yeah. Right. But that's okay. I mean, because that's what you do. You're a writer. You're a creative person. Yeah. Right. So like, there's no way you could expect it to completely separate that. Right. There's just no way, unless you like really fucking took a lot of seriously good drugs or something, but which we don't encourage. But you know, there's no way to completely separate from that. Right. But I mean, you have to have some, and I think that's a perfectly great way to do it. Play video games. Cause yeah, like sure, your wheels are still maybe spinning, right? Your creative wheels are spinning, which is just who you are. But you know, it's at some point you got to like there has to be a we all have to have separation between what we do and who we are.
Yeah.
Right.
I think balance.
I guess maybe the best way is like the best question is maybe like, how do you find balance?
Yeah. I think it's still like a work in progress for me. And it's hard because I think I also have the combination of like, I do have kids, and I think a lot of parents probably are familiar with this, but there's that moment of feeling like, I don't know who I am. I'm just somebody's parent, and they just are pulling out my hair and asking me for things and shouting at me. Like it's not, my kids are very good. I'm not trying to like put them out to, you know,
but sound awful. God.
No, they're great. But you know what I mean? In general, especially like the younger ones, and you just don't feel like a person anymore. And you sort of just feel like and so for me, I have that, but also the writing. And it's kind of like, I honestly, sometimes I'm like, have I like left my personality from like 10 years ago? And I just don't even know anymore. But I think maybe that's just a time thing that you just kind of work it out. But, and it's hard, obviously pandemic too. It's like, nobody's going anywhere. So,
well, I don't want to like harp on kids too much, but I mean, I don't have any myself, but I'm surrounded by them. And, like everyone I know has kids, and we've talked about that. Like you kind of lose a bit of yourself. And that's the deal though, isn't it? Isn't that
it is the deal.
Right? That's like that's not a secret. It's a well-known, like it just kind of comes with the territory. And you know, you've literally especially for women, because you've birthed them. Mm-hmm. So like it's literally like a physical giving up of a part of yourself, right? Like and it's like, and that's only gonna go one way, right? It you do end up having to give up a bit of yourself in that situation. That's just the deal. So that's okay to say that, I think too. But like I said, you know, because you are you're many things, right? You're a working mom, right? So you have to find that balance, you know, that sort of, and maybe it is just being a mom is distraction enough that gets your mind, you know, probably don't even realize it, but maybe when your kids are being little shits and you're having to go full mom on them, that maybe you aren't thinking about writing, even if it's only for 10 minutes, and maybe that's like good enough. I don't know, but.
Yeah. My kids are like they're like way too smart. I feel like they figured out, they have these like words that they use. Like if they're in trouble and I'm like lecturing them, they just like stare at me and like a dead straight face. And they'll just be like, this is not how you treat a child.
Oh my God.
Just like, I don't know how to respond to this. Like this, you're just standing there like, they've outsmarted me.
You're like, well, you should just start saying stuff like, well, you know how they treat children in other countries. You'd be a soldier by now. So, you know, like, I think you got it pretty good, kid. I thought you were going to say something like they've picked up on, you know, your job and are like, don't you have a deadline? And you'd be like, ah!
they were really funny the other day. They put like, they had this like list. We were talking about like, something about like expectations of the house or whatever. And so like my husband had this list and he was like, you know, this is what we expect. And like, what do you expect of us? Right. And so they gave their list for him. And then he's like, okay, what about mom? And they're like, she needs to stop saying, oh shit.
Oh no, that's hilarious.
I found that so funny though. I was like, if that's the worst thing that I feel like I'm okay.
You're doing good. You're doing your job. Yeah, you're doing a good job.
I was like, I do say that a lot though, because I get scared really easily because they're always, my kids hide behind the door. So when you come out of the bathroom, they're just right there and they just jump out. They're terrifying.
Huh. Yeah.
And so I frequently say, oh shit.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, so, I'm with you. If that's all they've got, then you're doing a good job. Right. Yeah, for sure. Your husband's list was probably a lot longer than that, than just oh shit.
Right? His was funny. I think they just wanted more candy, I'll be honest. Like it was like
their wants are simple. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, just personally and stuff too. Right. I think it's, you know, good advice for any young writer, you know, it's good to, you know, just try and find something, some healthy balance. Right. Because, and whether it's writing or any job, right. Like you can't throw yourself too much into anything, I don't think, because it's at some point it, you know, the body is very fallible. Right. So, especially the brain, it needs to reset once in a while. So whatever you need to do that, whether it's, play with your kids, play video games, whatever. Yeah. So
I'm hoping after the pandemic, and I think a lot of people probably will feel the same way, but I think as things start going back to normal, I'm hopeful that, you know, this will get a little bit easier.
Yeah. I think it will. I think it will for sure.
Yeah.
Everybody's tense and cooped up and
right. I think we're all maxed out.
Yeah. There's so many unknowns. That's the thing. There's so many unknowns. So I think once we get back into normal, things hopefully will fall back into place. Yeah. Okay. It's publishing hot topic time. And I know you avoid Twitter, so you might've missed these couple things entirely, but and because it was in the blurb there about your book, Diverse Books came out and said they're going to stop using own voices, like the term. when they talk about books and stuff like that. So they're not going to use it going forward because, you know, although they think it's a good idea, you know, it was a good idea. It's just been sort of like it's being used inappropriately or where it shouldn't, or as a weapon in some cases. And, you know, maybe by the wrong people. Mm-hmm. So they've decided just to move on from it. And they're just, I think they're going to just be more specific about, you know, instead of saying a blanket own voices, they're going to actually just talk about what is in, you know what I mean? The specific aspect of what is the own voice from this author. Right. So,
yeah.
And so instead of saying, you know, your book says fish out of water, own voices story, it'll just say like fish out of water, homeschooled kid. Right. It won't say own voices. Mm-hmm. It'll just say homeschooled. So what's your take on that? Are you good with own voices? The term have you noticed the way it's being used inappropriately at all?
Yeah.
Do you care at all? Do you not care?
I strongly dislike that term, and I have for a very, very long time. Shortly after Starfish came out, and I was on the sort of more negative end of some things and felt like I had to come out and say things that were own voices that I regret ever having to say because it just got used against me more and it wasn't nice. And I feel like, I think that's probably part of it too, is that a lot of authors feel like they get outed for different aspects of their identity because they're being like almost attacked for it not being own voices because people don't, you know, think it's not, and they're making assumptions. And then the author feels like, well, I have now have to come out and say it. And it's a whole mess and it's not nice. And because I've been on that side, I clearly have like a biased opinion towards what that felt like.
For sure.
And so I'm not going to knock anybody who likes using it, who felt like, you know, that empowered them. But for me, I did not feel like it was empowering. I felt like it made me feel very dehumanized, I guess, in a lot of ways. And I felt like for the last, you know, years, since 2017 when Starfish came out, I just feel like it has been like a constant uphill battle of almost having to defend who you are, like at every different level. And it's just exhausting. It's exhausting on all accounts. I mean, I've even had people like question, like, you know, they're like, oh, assuming that I'm not Asian, right? And then if I'm like, oh, I am Asian, they're like, well, how Asian? And then it's like, and then it's like, no, I'm, you know, this is my identity, blah, blah. And then it turns into like, I think one of the more recent ones was like, there was like a something, I won't be too specific because I don't want to get anybody in trouble, regardless of how they were, but of whether I was Asian American enough because I'm don't live in America anymore. Yeah, and so, I was thinking, you know, like I've been Asian American my entire life. You know, I was born there. I went to school there. I lived there for years and I still pay US taxes. So like, what is it that you are just, I don't know. And that's just like a small, you know, other people have a much more serious version of stuff too, to I'm sure to talk about, and but just a little aspect of it. And I've been over it for a while. I'm very glad that it's not going to be a standard anymore. Whether, you know, if somebody wants to use it still, I'm not, you know, totally fine. I'm not going to judge them, but I'm glad that it's not held as like an industry thing of like, this is what we're going to call it and this is what we're going to use. Because
Well, I don't know if we know that much yet, if it's going to be removed from the industry entirely, right? But I definitely think it's gotten away from its original intent. There's no questioning that. And I definitely think some people have used it to throw bigoted attacks at authors. 100%.
Yeah.
100% agree with that. And you and I have talked about this before, about, you know, people expecting too much from authors because of things like social media, and they feel like they're entitled to know more things about people than they ever should.
I think some people have like that mentality too of like, if this was my experience and if you didn't have my experience there, then you're wrong. And it's like, that's not how that works. Like own voices too. Like, okay, so you're writing about your experience of one thing. Like you could have like a ton of different experiences within that one identity. You see what I mean? Like, and it just feels like it felt like it got weaponized to be used to like hold authors to the standard of like, your representation didn't meet my criteria of what it should be, and therefore 100%. It's wrong. And
And that's led into the more recent topic of, I don't know if you heard about any of the discourse about trigger warnings and content warnings.
I haven't seen that recently.
So that's very like last few days type of thing. So, So basically it was Sylvia Morena who did Mexican Gothic. And she got into Twitter about a thread about content warnings and trigger warnings and stuff, and how it's in the same sense, how it's sort of gotten a little out of hand. Like people have used it, you know, as a weapon to attack people of color, authors of color and stuff like that. And so what ended up happening was, do you know what StoryGraph is?
No, so it's like so old. I'm sorry.
No, it's new. It's the new. Okay. It's these folks that launched it. It's an alternative to Goodreads, basically. It's supposed to be a healthier, okay. Healthier, better Goodreads.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. It was people of color that launched it. And it's really nice. It's really slick. It's a really good, really great option, alternative to Goodreads.
Okay.
But one of the things that people can do on it, like reviewers and bloggers, is they can add their own content warnings, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing to say they couldn't always just in their blurbs anyways, but you can add it in a way that comes up as just automatically, like when you type in that title. You know what I mean? So, and now this wasn't a lot of people, but some authors sort of dug into it. Some other authors, once they saw her thread and looked at it. And for example, like somebody's book just mentions Harry Potter, and then some user tagged it as transphobic, the book.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not.
Slightly side note, that has happened to me, and they tagged me in the review, and that was very annoying.
Yeah. So
I'll be honest with you, I took it out. The Harry Potter references were taken out before the book even published. So they read the arc.
And that
gutted me even more, because I was like, I actually removed it. And like, yeah.
This has happened now with this, where we have this really important thing. I think we can all agree content warnings are great,
mm-hmm.
And are important. And I don't want them to go away. But here's again something that came about with a well-meaning thing and was used by the right people in the appropriate circumstances in the appropriate manner has now been turned into a weapon. And it looks like it's aimed at authors of color and stuff, because what one of these other authors did was they compared like authors of color books trigger warnings to white authors trigger warnings. And the difference, I'm telling you, is might as well be Mars to Earth. unsurprisingly, of course, right, with everything else we know. And this isn't StoryGraph's fault. And I'm going to say, like, talk about amazingly swift reaction. StoryGraph came out this morning. They said yesterday they were going to fix it right away. And this morning they released a whole thing about how it's been fixed, and great for them. And it's a great example of how a website should respond. They've done exactly the right thing for something that wasn't their fault to begin with. No one's saying StoryGraph was at fault here. So they came out with a thing now today where there's author approved trigger warnings and content warnings. So they'll have like two columns. That's, sort of.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. A really smart fix, a really great fix.
Very smart.
Yeah. And they did it right away, and it's like kudos to them. So, you know,
that's something that's been going on for like a while too, you know, maybe not exactly in the context of trigger warnings, like specifically, but kind of, because I feel like, you know, trigger warnings, like for me, I feel like, you know, in general, right. Very, very necessary. And in some cases, like really important for somebody's health and well-being and stuff like that. And so like, I think they're great, and I think they're important. I think they should be there so that people can make up their own minds, whether they're in the right headspace or place in their life to consume a certain type of media. Right.
Yep.
But I feel like on this other end of it, well, maybe not other end of it, but on this other sort of like, you know, a like parallel kind of thread here, is that I feel like authors of color are held to much higher standards and held under a microscope for things that, and they don't get passes for stuff, and they don't get the context or the nuance that like mostly white authors will get, you know.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes their stuff gets twisted to mean something so that they can be put it in a negative light, rather than like understanding like, wait, this is a context of a story, there's like, you know, a bigger thing. And we just don't get the same grace. And I'm not saying that authors of color can't be problematic or write problematic books. Like, I get that, you know, everybody can make mistakes and stuff, but sometimes they're not actually mistakes. Sometimes it's just a context, or sometimes you're writing a messy character who's supposed to make a mistake. And I feel like, you know, things aren't seen as that when it's an author of color versus when it's a white author. And that's been going on for a long time. And it's, you know,
yeah. Well, I was talking to Lizelle. Speaking of launches today, Blood Like Magic came out, and I highly recommend that book. Lizelle Sanbury, and I was talking to her a couple weeks ago about it, and we were both, you know, total agreeance. And it's just to your point that you just made, authors of color, when they release a book, it has to be perfect. It has to be fucking light. It has to be lights out good. Has to be like a bestseller. Has to be this. It has to meet these incredibly unfair high standards, because they had to even get looked at, right? Like, to even be considered, you know what I mean? So it's racism, right? It's just pure fucking systematic racism. There's no other way to look at it. And one thing we her and I sort of had a laugh about, I'm like, well, no, it's equal when you release a book that's terrible. Because if I'm reading a book by an author of color that's horrible, and you know what I mean, like, and I mean consistently, then you know that the playing field has been leveled, right? So, right, that means they're allowing that, because how can I read 1,000 awful books by white authors that get published, but every black, you know, Asian, you know, go down the list, author has to, their book has to be fucking 5 stars, or you know, it gets just shit on, or it gets targeted, or harassed, or all the things we've just been talking about with either own voices hashtags or content warning hashtags just being used, not even just, you know, irresponsibly, but grossly, right?
Yeah, it's weaponized against them, and it sucks. Even this whole thing, I know there's like a thing about like tropes and stuff like that, and like the amount of times this is something that is like, this is the hill that I'm going to sit on and like with my soapbox. But the trope thing bothers me so much, because I feel like, you know, a lot of authors of color, we did not see ourselves in any of these tropes growing up, right? So we're writing books and putting like people of color as the main characters who are getting to experience these tropes for like some, in some cases, some of the first times, like for other people reading it. And then now is the time that people want to say like, oh, this trope is overdone. And it's like, how can you say it's overdone if you've never had, you know, an Asian girl in a ballroom scene?
Right.
You know, it's like, it's not overdone. It's like, we never got a chance to do this before. And like, now you want to cancel the trope. Like, and it's kind of like, how many, you know, and I love fairy books, don't get me wrong, but how many fairy books have we had with the same kind of theme, or vampire books, you know?
Yep.
And it's like, and they were fine with that. We had, you know, True Blood, Vampire Diaries, Twilight, all these ones that like, you know, Vampire Academy, all this stuff. And, you know, nobody was complaining. They were happy to keep consuming it. And now authors of color are stepping up and saying like, I would like to try this trope. And then they're like, oh no, like, I'm so tired of this. Like, and it's like, come on.
Well, I also hate like people like, oh, this book was too tropey. I'm like, no, that's, tropes are part of writing. Like, I mean, I don't
everything
know.
Is tropey.
Yeah. Like, I don't like tropey. That's like saying that sentence is meaningless, right? Like, it's like the saying the sun is too shiny.
Like, but I feel like it's one of those things that's like weaponized against 100%. More often than not people of color, because 100%. they use these, you know, this language and these words that make it sound negative. And it's like, and like I said, you take out the context, don't you? And it's like, that is something that, that's the hill that I'm on. I'm shouting down into the void.
And I mean, just like you know, Chorus Rises just came out too by Bethany C. Murrow, and it's, you know, it might be the book of the year for me, but, you know, somebody where I was going to great length, you know, about that book, about, you know, how that people are like, that's not world building. It's a contemporary book. I'm like, she's absolutely fucking world building, because she's presenting to us the black experience in America, which nobody seems to have any clue about. And like, you know what I mean? It'd be the same for an Asian experience too, right? Unless you're immersed in that culture, you're completely unaware of it.
Yeah.
And so she has to present, and you too have to present this reality to us that we're not used to seeing, and in a way that makes us, you know, not only of course enjoy the story, but understand, you know, the nuance of living in with that skin color is all about. I said, if that's not world building, then I don't know what is. Right. Like, you know, whether it's a space story or whatever, just presenting an alternative reality to a reader is world building, in my opinion. And because it's not my fault white people haven't bothered to learn about, you know, other forms of existence on this planet. Anyways.
Yeah, exactly.
Life. Isn't life great? All right. Generation Misfits. Millie is attending a real school for the first time, and she dreams of finally having friends and a little bit of freedom. She finds her chance when she joins an imitation band of her favorite J-pop group, where she's thrilled to meet a group of misfits who quickly become a tight-knit group of friends that are like family. But Millie soon realizes that one of them is dealing with problems bigger than what notes to hit when it comes time for their performance. Can Millie help her friend even their problem feels too big to say out loud? Even when their problem feels too big to say out loud. First off, shout out to Jen Bartel, who did the cover. I was, I know you, that you wrote in the blurb or your book about, I've had her stuff. Like, I've got her, some of her Star Wars stuff. So she's such a great artist, and, very, very cool that she got to do your cover too. And it is a really cool, fun cover. I like that because I like having an image of what the person looked like when I'm reading the story.
Yeah, I do too.
So that's really great for sure. So Generation Misfits is it's your debut middle grade, right? I mean, it's published middle grade. Have you even queried middle grade before? Like, talk to me about why middle grade and what made you do middle grade.
No, so this was the very, very first one. It was sort of, it was basically like me and my editor kind of like mind melded, I guess, this idea of kids meeting through J-pop. And I kind of brought a lot of my own experiences from being homeschooled into it. And yeah, so it was a new one for me because I hadn't written middle grade before. I've always been a YA writer. And so this was like kind of new territory, but like, to be honest with you, it felt a lot more natural than I thought it would be. And possibly that's because I changed it to third person, which sort of like allowed me to have like a new voice, if that makes sense, like a fresh voice. So maybe was a helpful kind of,
which you can have third person YA, but it's not the norm. Yeah. It's mostly first person YA. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So yeah, like the big thing about Millie's the star of this book for sure. And her deal is that, yeah, she's homeschooled or has been homeschooled up to this point. Mm-hmm. So, and I mentioned this too, but you know, you were homeschooled.
Yes.
And I mentioned this to you before, I think online a while ago, but I wasn't homeschooled like you were, but I moved around a lot when I was a kid, like a lot. So I was like the perpetual new kid and always having to make new friends. So I definitely related to that part of Millie's challenge, right? Like changing schools or being homeschooled and then going to school, suddenly like you have no friends, right? You've got to make friends. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting though, and specific to Millie's journey and then your journey as well. So I remember when I grew up, like being homeschooled carried with it like a certain negative context. Like I remember being kids and we viewed it as weird. Like they were weird kids if you were homeschooled, or it was like a religion. They were religious or something, right?
Yeah.
You know, this book I thought reads very well and realistic about Millie's struggles and not the antisocial context. Certainly, I think supersedes sort of the educational aspect of this book. But there is just like an educational aspect to this book where you talk about her struggles with the curriculum and the format and the system, right? It's quite different, right, than being homeschooled, obviously, like for obvious reasons. So talk about like what, like your experience specifically with homeschool. Like was it bad? Was it horrible? Was it okay? Like how was it for you?
So I guess just I should start off by saying that I realize that my experience is not going to encompass every single homeschooler.
No.
So what I'm saying is not saying that this is like, you know, the experience. But for me personally, I had a really hard time when I went back to a public school. I was homeschooled from fourth grade through up to eighth grade, which I feel like are very kind of formative sort of socializing, you know, years. And I'm aware that like other kids have, you know, there are homeschooling clubs, this is something that actually gets talked about in the book of, you know, her kind of like finding out from another homeschooler, like, you know, that they went to clubs to socialize and her parents didn't put her in that. And my parents did not put me, I think they had us in a volleyball once. One day I went, I got hit in the face and cried and then we never went back.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was my socializing for the whole year.
Well, I wouldn't either. Like if that's your only experience, you're like, yeah, volleyball sucks. I got hit the face.
I was just embarrassed. Yeah. And I think my brother was next to me and he was laughing. My glasses broke. God. It was a whole thing.
Right,
so,
right.
And so I didn't have friends that whole time that I was homeschooled, which was like really, really like, you know, kind of lonely. And so when I did go back, I think I had all these big ideas that like I really wanted to have like a friend and like I thought it would be maybe easier and it was not easy. But more important than the friend part, to be honest with you, was the school part of it, which was, you know, it's not that I felt, you know, badly prepared necessarily for like the academic side, but it was like there's a lot of rules that I think school systems assume that kids just know because they've been going to school since kindergarten, you know?
Right.
And so they don't teach you the things, like you don't get to school and then they walk you through all this stuff step by step that necessarily, you know, maybe a new kid who's been homeschooled might actually need to hear. Like I remember in my some of my classes, they would write the homework on the board and they never like, they didn't really explain it. And they had like these planners. And I remember like everybody else was just like pulling out these planners and like writing down the stuff. And I was just looking around like frequently being like, what is going on? Like, what are they writing? Like, how do they know? And then like every day, like homework would be due. And I was like, where are they getting this homework? And it was like really upsetting. Basically my first quarter back in eighth grade, I got D's in a bunch of classes and I actually had a teacher pull me aside And she was like, you can do better than this. And like, I just went home crying. I was so upset. And like, I was lucky at that point that I had made some friends that basically I started talking to them about it. And then they kind of helped me out being like, okay, here's the vocab. Like, this is what you have to study. And like, it made it a bit easier. And, but I was, you know, it was hard. It was not like an easy thing that I was just like, oh yeah, I was homeschooled and now I'm in public school. And it was an easy transition. Like it was tough for me. So
yeah. And like, that's, you know, a lot of, you just said sort of like parallels Millie's experience too, in a lot of ways. You know, ultimately a lot of Millie's issues come from her inability to speak up about it. Right. Yeah. It's not until she's able to, you know, find the courage to speak up about certain things is when sort of things start to really work out for her. Because, you know, there's a great line about, well, you know, every teacher's here to help. They're all here to help, right? But if they don't know the problem, they can't help with the problem, right? So, you know, they got to a point where they just assumed she wasn't putting in the work, right? Was too lazy or whatever. Did you find that difficult too? If you recall, like being able just to like express.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Your frustration with the system, yeah.
Yeah, when that teacher had pulled me aside and said that, and she meant it from like the best place. Like she basically meant it as like, you know, she was looking at it as, you're not applying yourself, like you could be doing better. And you know, because she's probably thinking this kid hasn't turned in any homework. Like, you know what I mean? And so I found that like terrifying though. I mean, I have social anxiety anyway, so I'm not good at talking to people or verbalizing how I feel even on a good day. So for me, that was just terrifying. Like, how was I going to explain to a teacher, you know, like, I just didn't know that was a safe space. I didn't know that was a thing that you could go and say to the teacher and that they weren't going to yell at you. Cause I think that was always my fear, is like, I don't want to get in trouble. And even now today, like, if there's a sign that says, don't walk on the grass, I do not walk on the grass. Like, that's just my personality. And so, you know, maybe if I had known that, like, you know, the teachers were like, you know, you won't get in trouble if you just come up. And I think in high school, I do remember teachers being more like that. I remember one teacher who said it, but they were like, look, if you can't do your homework and there's a reason, like, just come and talk to me, like, we'll figure something out. And I remember like, that was like wild to me. I was like, what? I was like, that's a thing that you can do, is like have a conversation and like, you know, but yeah, it was.
Yeah, that's like, it seems like such a funny, simple thing, right? But yeah, no, when you're a kid at a new school, basically, and you have like, God, you've got like, that's everything, right? Like you're constantly walking on eggshells and mm-hmm. having that courage and, you know, to be able to speak up and speak your mind like that, that's not easy to do. That's not easy. Fuck, most adults can't even do that.
Right, so, exactly, right? Yeah, so it's hard.
So why should we expect little Millie to be able to do that too? And not only that, she's got some sort of added pressures because this school is sort of like a performing arts school, right? Like where, mm-hmm. so she's there because she's is it a flutist? What do you call it?
Yeah, I think some people say flautist, and I play flute too, and I don't say that because it sounds ridiculous. So I say flutist, but.
You play flute too. So you are Millie, basically. This is a biography. Yeah. This isn't a middle grade. This is a biography. Okay, so flautist. She's also a flautist and a really damn good one. And so her parents are like, I always say like the hockey parents. So that's maybe a Canadian thing, but like real like, putting the pressure on for her to be a great a great flautist, because they see this as her ticket, right? It's her she's really fucking good at it and they really want her to succeed at it. And so there's a lot of pressure from at home as well, so there's no like respite for her, right? Because school sucks, home sucks, and her parents are fine, loving parents, but they sort of put the pressure on her, so there's no respite from it. And then now you have no friends, so life's not great for Millie at the beginning, right? She's struggling in just about every way a young person can struggle. Then she meets Zuki. Oh, Zuki. So they're on the cover. So like this book Millie's the star, but there's really five stars in this book. And I guess I got to ask at this point, because basically you're Millie. Did you have a Zuki? Who was your Zuki? Was there a breakthrough? Was there a breakthrough moment for you when you got to your first friend after coming back from being homeschooled that really was maybe a bit of a turning point?
Yeah, no, I didn't have a Zuki in the same sense. And I'm not, to be fair, I'm not 100% Millie either. I think
I'm just joking. I know I'm joking. It's fine.
Yeah, don't worry. So it's, I think Zuki probably would have been a friend that would have been really like the perfect other half for me to, you know what I mean? To have somebody that would be, you know, that outgoing and that like, you know, happy and just like take charge. And to be fair, I think that is like in a less colorful way, maybe the friends that I did gravitate towards are the ones who would make the plans. Like, I'm not the planner. I'm not the person who texts first. Like, I'm the person, like, you make the plans and tell me there's food. I'll meet you. I'm there, but I don't come up with, so that kind of personality type is like, sort of like, you know, the opposites attract sort of situation for Millie and Zuki. But it works really well for them, because I think that's what she needs to kind of like, you know, somebody to show her the ropes and make her just feel like she's wanted to, you know, somebody wants her around. And yeah, Zuki.
It starts out with just, they have just have the J-pop thing in common, right? So like, yes. Like the summary says, so they form this group for this, there's this fictitious group called Generation Love, mm-hmm. and this J-pop band. And they start this group together, and then, you know, they try to attract more people to it. It doesn't really work out so much. And then finally they find other people, like-minded people, and everyone's different. So, you know, Luna, Zuki, Ashley, Rainbow, and Millie, they're all the only thing they have in common is Generation Love, right? And their J-pop love.
Yeah.
So talk about sort of like developing this, because they're all diverse for different, they're all different for different reasons. And, you know, they're all great in different ways. I personally am team Rainbow. mostly for the veganism, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm also team Maseo. Is it Seo? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ashley. Her mom is like a superhero. Talk about just rounding out the group though, because yeah, it's you bring in, they're all different for different reasons. I mean, obviously there's some Ashley and Luna have a history, but you know, they're all different. So talk about just sort of like when you were coming up with it with these different characters.
Yeah, so this idea was kind of founded on this like sort of a sort of Breakfast Club-ish thing, you know, yeah. mixed with anime.
Yeah.
So it's like a group of misfits who would not ordinarily probably be friends. They're just very, very different, but they have this passion that like, you know, bonds them, or, you know, this event that bonds them, kind of thing. And so for them, this is this J-pop group called Generation Love. And they're all obsessed. And Zuki has this idea of starting a band, like an imitation band. And so it kind of just like, they sort of find each other, I guess. And it has that found family aspect that I love and is probably in a lot of my books. But I just like it because it's just this idea of like, you don't have to be blood related. Like if you grew up and you didn't have the family that you needed or the family that you wanted, like, that it's okay. You can still find those people. And I think there's something very hopeful and like nice about that for, you know, for people to think like it's not the end just because you didn't, you know, you weren't born with the perfect kind of setup. So yeah. So they're all very different.
They all serve like different roles kind of in a way, right? Like, mm-hmm. because they each bring something different to the table. And it's funny how I like how problems are unique, but it's the group that's going to help them. They couldn't have, you know, there's no other way they could have gotten through this stuff without this particular group of people coming together, I feel like.
Yeah, they were like meant for each other.
Right. It's right. Yeah. Like, it's almost like the Alice in Wonderland, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, Rainbow needed courage. Mm-hmm. You know, she needs a bit of courage, right? Because she's had a couple of bad sort of experiences publicly, right? And she, you know, people have given her a hard time. So she needs to find her courage again. And it's through these specific people she does that. Luna's, you know, like we said, is sort of a popular person, and, you know, maybe needs these people to show her that that's maybe not like a shallow existence, but there's more to life, right? than being the cool kid or whatever. And you need to go down the list for the different characters too, right?
Yeah. Luna's a bit misunderstood, I think, is her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you know, her friends are the other friends. The friends outside of the group are, you know, like not super great.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like she's torn, and like she's a person of two worlds in a lot of ways, right? So
yeah, I think each of them have a degree of insecurity. I think that's where it stems from. All different shades of what that is and what that means to them, but they all have an insecurity that, you know, these kind of people help them work through, I guess, and see it. So
yeah, so there are some, you know, this book does get a little dark on a couple, in a couple of instances, and mostly through Zuki. So her home life, we won't get into details, but her home life isn't super great. She doesn't like, you know, like Ashley, for example, her mom their mom is a teacher and at the same school, and mm-hmm. is just like completely, she's like a super person, right? She's completely reasonable, she's smart, she's very empathetic, is super super stoked with Ashley and the path you know they've chosen, you know, has a party and, you know, is just nice enough to have a vegan pizza for Rainbow. You know how many parties I've been to when no one's given me a vegan pizza? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
It's such a nice little extra thing to do, right? But anyway, so yeah, so it's you know, Zuki doesn't have a Mrs. Sayo in her life. So, you know, I think you balanced sort of the darkness with the light in this book enough. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like it's a middle grade. So I mean, you can't get too crazy with it. Right. But, you know, talk about sort of like, because, you know, the problems that Zuki have they actually do take over the story at one point, because it's when you become friends with somebody, you know, there's a lot of found family sort of ideas in this book. Right. And, of course, they're just naturally worried for Zuki, and so that sort of takes over a lot of the storyline of the book. What was the idea with that? Like, how far did you want to go with that? You know, how does it affect the ending? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, because I do write books that are about characters, right? And mm-hmm. and I feel like it, realistically, you know, people are going through stuff, like, and sometimes way more than you think. Like, somebody could be laughing and smiling, and you have no idea, you know, what they're dealing with behind closed doors. And I think that just speaks to real life. I'm not somebody who glosses over kind of like the dark things in life and the sad things in life. I'm somebody who kind of faces it, you know, in my writing, and is like, you know, this is what it looks like, and this is how there can still be hope. And that's sort of like what I always kind of try to write these, you know, narratives around, is that sense of like, there's still light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing. But you know, it is middle grade, and I feel like, you know, sometimes you don't need to write stuff necessarily for shock value. At least I don't personally feel like that. I don't need to necessarily have you see all the worst things on the page, right? You know, because I'm more focused on, okay, so this stuff is happening behind closed doors, but what do you see of this character? Like, how is this character responding to this? Like, you know, how is it affecting them? And that comes from the character kind of part of it. But so I think that was the focus in this, is sort of how Zuki is reacting and how she's trying to cope and failing to cope and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I think you give kids a lot of credit in this book too, right? Like, they're mm-hmm. they're much more intuitive than we realize, and you know, and they pick up on stuff, right? And yeah. Because there's some things that maybe, you know, even like Millie, who's her closest friend, didn't pick up on, that other people sort of brought to her attention. You know what I mean? They're all so intuitive and smart about it. And
yeah,
you know, I like the part about Millie where it's like, you know, no one's doing anything about this. No, what's anybody doing about this problem? And then when she brings it to an adult, adult's like, no, we know, like, it's, we're on it. Just, and that's one of the important things too. One of the important lessons in this book. And I think this book has a lot of great lessons in it. Just being there for somebody, you know what I mean? Is enough sometimes. And that's one of the things I like you wrote too in the book at the end about in your acknowledgements part, you know, you said, that's who I wrote this book for, people like Millie who struggle with things that most other people don't and who just want to feel like they're not alone in the world. And like, that's an important lesson. And that's not I like that, because it's not like, you know, I am the cure all, I am not the fix all. Like, I'm not going to be able to solve your problems, for Christ's sakes. I'm just a little kid, you know, but like, sometimes just being there, a friendly, warm presence can be everything to somebody. Inviting them over for Christmas dinner, for example, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Is sometimes like, that's, might as well be like Superman.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, I think in real life, it's like, you know, it's just, sometimes you just need somebody to reach out, and sometimes you just need somebody to sit with you and watch a movie and not say anything. And, you know, that can be the difference between, you know, you being at home feeling like completely alone and, you know, sad and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah.
It's almost like a series, you know, a series of gestures, you know, can change mm-hmm. the world. And, you know, there's a really, really great part where yeah, they're having the party for Ashley, although they didn't know it. and Luna does something really nice for Ashley at that part, because they have a bit of history, and she gives her a gift, and it means a lot. And it's such a small, stupid little thing, right? In the grand scheme of life for adults, but I mean, God, to them, that's such a huge moment. By the time this airs, this book will have already come out. So I assume, do you have any preference where people pick up Generation Misfits?
Your indie bookseller, if you're able, is probably the one I always kind of try to promote. From there, I think there's like leveling degrees of where we want to go with, but obviously everybody's situation is different, and I get that,
However you can get it, basically. But let's not give any money to that guy who's flying to the, where's he going? To the moon or something now, or Mars? I don't know where he's going.
I have no idea, but no judgment. I understand that some people, that's the only place they can shop. So I get it.
I understand. If you can get to an indie bookstore,
I'm just grateful. And libraries are wonderful too. And if they don't have them at your library, requesting them is a huge help as well, because then they order copies in. So it's all good things.
It's all good. So, talking about it online, leaving reviews, doing all that stuff is all helpful to an author for sure. So, Kemi, I can't thank you enough. As you know, I am not prone to bullshit, and I just love the heck out of this book.
Thank you.
Well, we talked about this, like, there's so many, like, it's either a product of we like the same things, or we just grew up at the same time, but we have similar tastes, because there's a really funny line about Studio Ghibli in this book, and there's a lot of really great stuff in here. I think something for everybody, and I think it really does sort of, like, it's got a really nice sort of cross generational appeal to it, I think, that a lot of people like, because there's lessons for kids and adults in this book, I think. And that makes it a great read for all different ages for sure. And I think this would be a great book for parents to read.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
So, because not just how to pick up the good things, but maybe the bad things. I think maybe some parents don't realize maybe they are being a little too hard on their kids. And I don't mean physically or abusive. I just mean like understand, be empathetic more to like what's happening with kids, because that's such a delicate age. Like you said, that's like the prime time when you're learning your socializing skills. You know what I mean? And
we're in an age of helicopter parenting right now too, I've heard. So
all right. I basically just go easy on the floatus. Let them have some friends. Maybe they don't want to be first chair. Maybe second chair is good enough. But those were some good scenes too. Millie's got a, I'm glad, there is some, you deal with some serious themes in this book, but and I think I commented to you about the ending, how would it have killed you to do this, it's a nice ending, but where I think like everybody, not all the problems in the world are fixed, right? That's not how things work. That's not how life works. But I think you get this group into a really nice spot at the end, and they understand more about each other and more about life at the end of it. And that's all you can ask for. So when Generation Misfits 2 comes out and they're in college, we'll see if they're still friends.
Oh, giant flash forward.
They're all just strung out and just like hate each other.
Oh no.
But I can't thank you enough for coming on, Akemi. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
There you have it. Another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Akemi, as always, for taking the time to chat with me from Scotland, no less. It's always a lot of fun, and with the recent title and cover reveal of The Genesis Wars, the second book in the Infinity Court series, I can't wait to talk to her again. Generation Misfits is her first attempt at middle grade, and she hits a home run, in my opinion. It's out now, so head on over to akemidonbowman.com to order a copy today. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.